right, welcome to Season 3, Episode 4, which is Episode 76 of the Retro Game Club podcast. I am Rob, and with me is someone who did not buy GameStop stock, is Hugh.
That's right. I kind of wonder if I could have. So like way, way back 100 years ago in the 90s, when I worked at one of the precursors to GameStop, I believe there was like a program where employees could buy slightly discounted stock, because every company has one of those, you know, some sort of purchase program. But when you're making like $5 an hour, you don't really think a lot about, should I buy some stock that potentially might get converted to something worth money in 30 years?
Yeah, yeah. Through Reddit subreddits.
Right, right. Through Reddit, a thing that did not exist in the 90s. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and don't worry, listeners, we're not going to try to explain this. I think it's funny all these video game podcasts trying to explain financials to their listeners. Like, suddenly everyone is a finance expert now. I don't
Yeah, no, I mean, I understand how shorting stock works. Like, I understand the mechanics of what's going on. Mm-hmm. That part I'm all fine with. I do own stocks and stuff today as a full-blown adult, you know, normally would. But I don't get into shorting, but I would never get into stock shorting or anything more advanced than fairly basic transactions.
Same here, yeah. But what have you been up to?
That's a good question. I got to look at the notes here. What have I been up to? I don't know if you ever listened on Spotify to the 8-bit Big Band. Have you heard of them?
I've heard of them. I don't listen to it though. But
they're really great.
Yeah.
Very professional. Like, I don't know, they must have 100 members. It's insane how large this group is. They do videos of like the recording process and everything.
Yeah.
But they put out something new this month, a new album, and I just happened to catch that it has Birdman, a song that we've talked about on the show a few times, is one of the songs they do a cover of, and it's really good.
Nice.
So,
nice.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're kind of stuck at home, you know, working, it's pretty good music because it's not distracting, really.
Is that the Dan Hess song?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'll have to send that to him, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And, you know, because I've been stuck indoors for a long time and it's winter, I've been doing a lot of dusting and cleaning, which is always very exciting. But through the course of it, I've been, like, going through my game shelves, and I found that I had, like, a huge stash, not huge, stash of 13 Atari 5200 games. And it occurred to me that I don't own an Atari 5200, and I don't ever plan to own an Atari 5200, just because logistically it's not an easy system to play anymore.
Yeah,
you know, it has old school TV hookups, and it takes up a ton of space, and you pretty much will have to go out and buy some sort of repro controller.
Yeah, all the controllers broke, all of them.
All yeah, literally every one that was ever made. So I'm like, oh, I bet. Hey, it's retro Atari games. Supposed to have to get something on eBay. It turns out Atari 5200 games get nothing on eBay. I saw other people selling like the exact same 13 games I was going to sell for like $10 with zero bids. So if anybody wants some free Atari 5200 games, email at retrogameclub.net.
Yeah. Nice.
It's either that or I'm going to organize a retro junk box or something.
Yeah, that's funny. So how will we do this? The first come, first serve kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah. First of all, no one's going to reply, so it doesn't matter. But if someone does, it's first come, first serve. presumably because you either own a retro game store, in which case I'm happy to donate stuff to your store, especially when it's probably a very, very hard time to run a retro game store. And or if you're just want to get into Atari 5200 collecting. None of these are rare. These are all like the 13 most common Atari 5200 games. I mean, they look kind of neat. I mean, if you just want, like, I was reading about how there's this store online called, like, Books by the Foot. Have you heard of this?
No.
So if you just want books for, like, the background of your house, they're very popular because people are using them now while they're working from home.
And
they want to look smart.
The backdrops, yeah.
Yeah, backdrops. So you just are like, I want, like, this many feet of books in this color spine or from this time period or like this genre. And they will just send you a box of books. they have a warehouse of hardcover books and you can just get, you know. So you could do the same thing with retro games if they weren't more expensive, right? Like, yeah. Books, old books are just super cheap. I mean, you can get warehouses of old books, I'm sure, for next to nothing. I think of all the, like, the estate sales you've gone to where it's just hundreds and hundreds of books nobody wants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's what this company does, is just creates nice looking backgrounds for you. But you could do the same with video games. So if you just want, like, a wall of Atari 5200 games behind you for some reason, that's a valid reason to want these games.
Nice, yeah.
Because it would look authentic. You know, if you're, like, want to do a YouTube channel where you're standing in front of a wall of games, having at least one shelf of 5200 games would give you some credibility.
Are there any good games in there?
They're all just comments. It's all arcade stuff, you know.
Okay.
Pac-Man, Centipede, that kind of stuff.
That's what the 5200 was for, really.
Yeah, it was for slightly better versions of games you had on the 2600 already.
Yes.
I mean, the launch lineup of the Switch was basically just, here are games that were on the Wii U, but now a little bit better. The Switch has obviously grown considerably, but in the beginning, it was kind of the same situation. And then, you know, even though, like, I'm trying to, like, free up a little bit of space, every time there's, like, some Sega CD reprint on limited run games, I end up buying it.
Do you open any of those, or do they just stack up?
If it's not a duplicate, I open it. So the one they did this time was the 32X version of Night Trap, which I guess you could play now, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, when I get that adapter, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I have a 32X and Sega CD and component cables. Yeah, component cables. So that one I'll open because I do want to play the 32X version of Night Trap because I don't own it. Some of the other ones I bought are ones I already have. And I don't know why I bought them. Who knows? Yeah. So that's about it for me, man. What have you been up to?
Not too much. Playing some future Game Club games a lot. And one of them with my son, but I won't get into that till we do those as Game Club games. And yesterday stopped by Nerd Out in the Detroit area with Randy, who was a guest on the show once, the owner of the store, and almost purchased a bunch of old Star Wars stuff, but just got, you know, some Mario and Luigi little figures for my son. But other than that, you know, nothing new is on TV, really, since Hollywood was kind of shut down for a long time. So I've been catching up on old movies I either love and haven't seen in a while or just never watched. And, you know, last night I watched The Last Starfighter, which was actually the first or second movie I ever saw in the theater. And I was really young then. And that has some scary moments if you're a little kid. But what a fantastic movie. It really is. And it got me thinking about, I don't know if you know this or our listeners know this, but this might be a good topic of the week sometime. But they made a Last Starfighter game, but it's not the game that's in the movie. And so some people were disappointed by that. And they actually programmed, you could get it on GitHub. They programmed the actual game that's in the movie. And then you could also download the schematics for the arcade cabinet that's in the movie and get the artwork too. It's pretty much a, what is it, tank? Something like that. Arcade cabinet ripoff. But yeah, so it just kind of got me thinking about all those little fun projects like that. This week I tried to put together my Mister, but kind of ran out of time. And I wanted to do it correctly, and I was getting a bit frustrated with it. So that'll be for a future episode as well. But yeah, we have a cool topic this week and a bunch of news. Oh, I also wanted to mention that our listeners might have noticed our bumper music has changed a bit. We're just kind of playing around with stuff, see what works. Zach offered to slice and dice some audio for us. Thank you for that, Zach. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how this new music thing works. So should we jump into the episode?
No, I want to talk about Last Starfighter real quick.
Yes, I was hoping you'd say that.
I do own the NES cartridge for Last Starfighter. Mm-hmm. And what happened was they just rebranded a Commodore 64 game.
Oh, okay.
Like it wasn't a game based at all on the movie. It was literally like, here's a shooter. It's set in space. We're just going to call it The Last Starfighter.
Is it any good?
It's all right. I mean, I'm not like, not huge into shooters. So I'll say it's an okay shooter. Not my favorite, but again, I'm a very bad judge of what's a good shooter.
Yeah, yeah. But you should check out that GitHub of the people who actually programmed the real game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't aware it was a real game, but I remember it was like an Atari, I think it was Battle Tank
cabinet. That's what it was. Yeah, that's what the cabinet was.
That they modified something like that.
Yeah, it wasn't a real game back then. I mean, there's no way those graphics would happen in a...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the cabinet was like they reskinned a real game cabinet. Mm-hmm. They didn't build that cabinet from scratch, I don't think.
No, yeah, you're totally right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, and so I did see The Last Starfighter in the theater as well, although I don't remember it all that well. I remember the South Park episode that's based on Last Starfighter a little bit better.
I don't know if I've seen that one.
Yeah, there's one, but it involves like it's when the PSP was a new system. That's how long South Park's been around. Because it was centered around the PSP.
Oh, nice. It's a great movie. It holds up today really well. It was one of those movies I kind of put in to help me fall asleep, and then I ended up watching the whole thing. Like, cool. Now it's like 1 in the morning and I'm awake.
Yeah. And you could see like the basic premise of Last Starfighter, you could still see today, right? I mean, it would be different because it would be people playing on Twitch and all that, right? Mm-hmm. But the basic premise of like the military or NASA or whoever is trying to recruit the best starfighter in the world through a video game. I can see that, you know.
There's a really... I've talked about this on this show before, but there's a really good show called Future Man on Hulu. And it's the plot of The Last Starfighter. And they call it out in the first episode, you know, when the kid is going through that whole plot. After it's explained to him, he literally says, like, oh, so The Last Starfighter. So, yeah, definitely suggest Future Man and The Last Starfighter.
Yeah. I mean, eventually, like, the closest analogy, I think at some point in our lifetime, one of these, like, Madden football champions will end up getting hired as, like, you know, offensive coordinator assistant or something for a team. I think we may get to that someday.
I hope so. I hope that happens.
Maybe they make more money winning Madden tournaments. I don't know what you get paid for winning Madden tournaments. It's probably a pretty decent amount, though.
Yeah. Retro news.
Yeah. I was going to talk about Madden football, but yeah, let's go.
Yeah. There is a new arcade game, literally a PC board that you would put in an arcade cabinet, called Tiger Queen Shark. And it used to be... or probably still is, an Android and Apple game. And the developers literally recoded it and put it on a board that you could plug into a JAMA cabinet. JAMA is the kind of arcade cabinet standard wire set. And yeah, it looks pretty fun. It looks like 1942 or something like that. And had a goal of about $6,000, and they made it to $16,000, almost $17,000 right now. So not bad.
Now, you have to have the hardware to use this, though, right?
Yeah. So a lot of people that collect arcade cabinets, like I have a cabinet that's just like a JAMA cabinet, where a lot of people just have it for testing, or you could just throw in almost whatever, PC board you want, you know. So that's pretty much, you know, it's a very niche market. On Polygon, the artist Takaya Imamura retires, and he was the creator of Tingles and some Star Fox characters and F-Zero. He had a pretty good career, pretty lengthy career.
Been with Nintendo since 1989.
Yeah.
So responsible for a lot of Super Nintendo and Onward characters.
Yeah, kind of a legend. And I hope I pronounced it correctly.
He's probably not listening, but...
Probably not. We do have some listeners in Japan.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, so it's kind of sad to see him go, but, you know, we did report a few weeks ago that Nintendo is set up to kind of let this happen without the Nintendo vibe ever going away. But, yeah, yeah. Sorry to see him go. What else do we have here?
So this is a Commodore 64 case that I guess you can mod and put other stuff in.
Yeah, you don't even need to mod this case. This is pretty neat. So it looks exactly like a Commodore 64 keyboard and all. But it is an ITX standard case that has its own power supply. It has a 5 1/4 slot that you could put, you know, a DVD drive or something, or, you know, an SD card reader or something like that, even though I think it has a built-in SD card reader. So, I mean, they have ITX motherboards for, like, 64-core processors.
Oh, yeah. Now, yeah.
So you can make a beast of a machine out of this if you wanted to. You probably couldn't use one of those because I doubt a graphics card could fit in this, but... Yeah, it's a really, really nice looking box.
Yeah, I mean, Mini ITX, I run something similar to Mini ITX. They're great if you aren't planning to put like a massive video card. You know, I mean, if you're just basically using your computer for programming and regular, what I'll call regular computer stuff.
Yeah.
And you aren't worried about massive video cards, then they're pretty solid. And yeah, they're quiet. Yeah. More, that's a really important part, is they're very low heat, so you don't have to have a massive fan.
Yeah, I mean, the graphics cards are usually bigger than the actual motherboards, and yeah, the APUs you could get are more than enough to you know, do RetroArch or stuff like that, and I mean, it's pretty much what the Atari box is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, still haven't gotten the email to get my Atari box controller.
Yeah, you're gonna be waiting for that for a while, I suspect.
For a long time. Speaking of cards you plug into computers, Hackaday has a cool article about hacking your ISA bus and PCI bus. It's way over my head, but if you ever want to make a PCI card or an ISA bus card, this is definitely your starting point.
It's really high on my list, yeah.
Yeah. So, for our smarter listeners, this is the article for you.
And then Experimental Pi.
Yeah. It's a
good name.
Yeah, it's a this on Retro Dodo. There are two Pi Boys that never got released that look really cool. So a Pi Boy is like a case you would throw in a Raspberry Pi to make a little handheld game machine. And this top one in this article looks fantastic. It almost looks like a Game Boy if you flipped it on its side and put the controllers on the side. But if you click on the post to see the other pictures of it, it's literally a Raspberry Pi 4 inside this really cool case that has a built-in, you know, what's that, 3.5-inch screen. So you see, you know, the Ethernet adapter and all that stuff, and it does, you know, the USB-C. You plug it in USB-C to power it or to charge it and all that stuff. But yeah, it'd be cool if these came out. Now, our next article I put in here because a buddy of mine's buying it, and I think I might buy.
Yeah, I saw this showed up in my like news feeds also. So this is a system that looks kind of like a Switch that is, it's called the Odroid, and it's an Android screen with a, you know, basically picture a Nintendo Switch, but it's running Android and is probably made with much cheaper components.
It looks really nice. Yeah, Odroid is a competitor to Raspberry Pi. They're usually more powerful, but I don't think this one is. I think they kind of Raspberry Pi 4 kind of tied mm-hmm. it up, but yeah, 5-inch screen. Like you said, it's a Switch, but you put RetroArch or something on it.
Something, yeah.
I think I need this. I'm going to wait. My buddy ordered one. I'm going to get his review before I order one because I need to get out of the habit of ordering stuff that I end up not using.
Yeah. Yeah. I have that problem too. I have to cut back on the amount of junk I order. I never played Super Mario Sunshine, so you'll have to explain this one to me.
So this is on Kotaku. A Super Mario Sunshine mod turns every NPC into a Chuckster. So in Super Mario Sunshine, there's a character or two that when you talk to them, they end up throwing you right after you talk to them. And sometimes it'll cause you harm. Sometimes it throws you to an area you need to be. Well, this mod, anytime you talk to any character, which is a lot in Super Mario Sunshine, they just throw you right afterwards. So if you want the most annoying mod ever, they've got you. Yeah, not much more to say about that one.
And do Ocarina of Time demo. Someone a leaked Ocarina of Time demo and some secrets about the game.
Yeah, they're... were different medallions you could get before the game was released that they removed, where you could turn into a fairy, you can extinguish fire, you could cloak yourself in darkness, you could shoot fire-like arrows. The map was a little bit different. The villages were obviously more simple because it was, you know, not a completed product. But, yeah. I don't think there's... Is there a video or anything here? I clicked something. Oh, I just clicked this and it downloaded the demo. Okay.
Okay.
So now I have it. Well, there you go. So my computer probably has a virus on it now.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, you probably want to burn your hard drive after this.
Yes. On RetroRGB... there is this really cool article and video about Neo Geo Open MVS. So MVS is Neo Geo's arcade board. So the AES is the home version of the MVS. Same hardware, really. That was the whole point of Neo Geo. But the Open MVS takes your one of the models that would be in the arcade cabinet and consolizes it for you. So this has a way to, if I'm reading this right, you could 3D print the case, you could create the PCB, it gives you links to, you know, any batteries or anything you need or any other adapters. Really, really cool project here.
Yeah, it's a kit you got to pre-order, and it's a do-it-yourself kit, and they're $200, which includes... the power supply, console and power supply.
Oh, wow. So does it actually come with the board?
It says, will include the console and a Meanwell 5-volt 3-amp power supply. Add-ons. Wow. And then there's a bunch of stuff. Now, they also said they can't guarantee you'll actually get one.
Because they probably have only so many of the boards.
Right.
Interesting.
So I think the board is another 150.
Okay.
I mean, looking at what you can order here.
I mean, at that point, you could just buy on eBay, just buy an AES, Neo Geo AES.
Oh, I don't think you can.
I mean, I got mine for less than that, but I mean, that was... 15 years ago.
Yeah, the Neo Geo is like sort of a famously expensive system on eBay, I thought.
Okay, now we gotta look. Neo Geo
A. You're not getting one for under $400, it looks like.
Oh, man. Oh, wow. So I got a deal back in the day. That's great. Good job, me. Anyways, kind of speaking of Neo Geo, there is a Polygon article, Capcom versus SNK, an oral history. And it's a really nice article. I didn't finish it, but it goes into how the Capcom versus SNK games came out, because Capcom and SNK, which is pretty much Neo Geo, they were rivals. In fact, the guy who coded the original Street Fighter jumped ship and went to SNK to create, you know, King of Fighters and all those games.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really cool that these games actually got released and created, and people really like these games. So, yeah. Nice little write-up.
Don't remember who added this one, but there's a new Pico System handheld. And this is essentially, I think I added this. This one works with the newest Raspberry Pi microcontroller. So the new system they released that's super tiny and like $4.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that would have any like gaming applications, but these guys already have basically a keychain sized case with a little screen, and you can plug the Raspberry Pi microcontroller in and play whatever it's capable of emulating.
Yeah, my guess is probably the 8-bit systems, maybe the 16-bit systems, tops, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know.
And it's only a 1.14 inch screen.
Yeah, yeah, it's tiny. I mean, the hardware you're putting in is pretty tiny too. So this is a real like novelty item, but kind of neat.
Yeah, pretty much something for your keychain or something like that.
The folks over at Rare, you know, the game developer, they posted an article about the stop and swap feature they had, which Nintendo, the punchline of this whole story is Nintendo sent them a long letter saying, please don't do this anymore. But they had like invented some technology where you could, unlock different things in their games by swapping cartridges while the console was turned on.
That's terrifying.
Right. And Nintendo basically said, one, we don't think people should be doing this. And two, like the technique you're using, it isn't necessarily going to work in all iterations of Nintendo 64 hardware. And then they send some alternative things like, what if you had a password that you could use in one game, you know, like you get a password and you enter that password in the other game. I'm surprised they didn't mention the memory card. Like certainly you could have done something with the Nintendo 64 memory card instead.
Oh yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. So that was, it seems like such a terrible idea, but
probably a reason it never saw the light of day.
Well, it's like there's at least one Genesis game that uses the reset button as a mechanic.
Really? How?
I think it's a role-playing game, and at some point, like, you know, the king or someone, it's like a fourth wall thing, like they tell you to hit the reset button to continue, and it works. And for doing some Genesis programming, that reset button just triggers a hardware interrupt, which your game is free to do whatever you want with.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't have to reset the system.
Yeah, you don't have to reset anything when you get the reset command.
Okay.
You're like, okay, well, that's nice. Thank you. You know, just
that is weird. We did skip one article, but it's not an article. This
this
pleasures.
One. Yeah. I'm going to include it too. So over on the a blog we talk about quite a bit, nerdlypleasures.blogspot.com. They have a comparison of Apple II disk emulators. So if you you know, are into Apple II emulation, you should probably check this out. This is really cool stuff. They have a little floppy emulator. I mean, so this is actually like you hook up this emulator to the Apple hardware. Like they have little LCD screens on with like what disk image you're loading. Mm-hmm. And then you actually run the cable into the Apple. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, those devices are really neat. Yeah.
Let's see. The voice actor of Sonic the Hedgehog is also retiring, or at least not doing Sonic the Hedgehog anymore.
Yeah, I didn't organize our stories very well this week.
That's all right.
But yeah, he definitely wasn't the first Sonic voice, and he definitely won't be the last. But yeah, he was in Sonic Forces and Lego Dimensions, Sonic Team Sonic Racing, Sonic Generations. He did the voice in Sonic Boom, which not a bad little cartoon. And Wreck-It Ralph as well. I forgot Sonic was in that. So, yeah, we wish him well. This might be my favorite article of the week. This is on Kotaku. More Sonic news. Modded Sonic games are zoomed out to the heavens. And this is a mod for Sonic 1 and 2, where they actually, I think they took the mobile game ports of it, and they zoom out all the way, so you see almost the entire level, but you still play the game. And it obviously makes the game way different, but it's really interesting. It's hard to tell where you are on these maps when you're actually playing a Sonic game. Mm-hmm. And this takes away that mystery. There's a video of it. And wow, the level design on Sonic is really, really impressive when you see it like this. I think this is Chemical Zone that...
It is, yeah. Because we want to see the whole map at once.
Yeah, really cool programming they probably had to do to pull this off. Yeah, I definitely suggest anyone who's a Sonic fan to check this out, because it'll make you look at the Sonic games completely differently.
So the next two articles, I'm going to dub the worst two articles of the show. Plex is launching a game subscription service filled with Atari games. So, yeah, if you want to pay a monthly fee for Atari games that you can buy a collection of for $9.99, this is the deal for you.
Yeah, $5 a month for right now 27 games. They're adding more. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work on all systems. In fact, it doesn't work on most of them. I do have a Plex Pass, so for me, it would be $3 instead of $5, even though I'm still not going to do it. And they also come out and say in this press release that, hey, this was built on, you know, as a side project by some passionate employees. That's why it made it in here. We don't guarantee this will stick around long. Like, Cool. Well, nice launch there.
Yeah, I mean, or you could just buy, like, Atari Flashback for $19 at the most.
Yeah, yeah, and be done with it. Use it, yeah, on almost any system. So, there you go. I'll let you take this next one, since you said it was your other least favorite.
All right, here's a long Sega Saturn. So this is a Sega Saturn, but it's longer.
Yes.
There you go.
Now, this is a dev kit, right?
Yeah, sure. It must be.
So, this Sega Saturn address checker was a development unit that made sure games weren't violating Sega's guidelines and memory usage. Okay.
All right.
Well, yeah, it looks like a very bad rendering of a Sega Saturn, but yeah, there you go.
And then, let's see, you got two more here. We have connecting your NES Classic Mini controller to a desktop computer, since it does use some crazy port. This is another do-it-yourself project, though. You have to have some hardware skills, it looks like.
Yeah, not too bad, but yeah, I'm not going to do it. But yeah, those controllers are nice, so, and you could get them for pretty cheap. So I guess this would, maybe it'd be less latency. I don't know. But, yeah. All right. Kind of cool. And this last article kind of ties into our topic of the week. We actually have a topic this time.
Yeah.
So this is on epilogue.co, and this is the GB operator. Play and manage Game Boy cartridges on your computer. So... I think what this does is you put in your Game Boy cartridge, plug this thing into your computer. This actually has a built-in emulator. And so you could play your Game Boy carts on your computer. It also, in real time, does save states. So if you bring this to a different computer, mm-hmm. you could continue playing. This detects counterfeit cartridges. So you could, I don't know, maybe bring this in a laptop to a store with you to see, you know, if an expensive cart you're getting is counterfeit or not. And I think you could use it for homebrew development.
That's what they say, yeah. I mean, it's a little light on the details, but that's what they say.
Yeah, shipping in April, it's $50, which is not a bad price if it does all this pretty well. Yeah, kind of neat. The GB Operator. So I'm sure we'll report on it once it's out there and reviewed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see, like, what OS it supports. There's a lot of questions I have about this that are not answered on this page.
Well, it could work for Windows, Linux, and Mac, and it has built in the M, like, the lowercase m, GBA emulator, which I guess is a fine emulator. So I don't know how that works, where if it's built in, how does your computer recognize it? Like, yeah, there are some questions there. Mm-hmm. But, our topic of the episode is 90s console cartridge copiers. So I was texting with a buddy of mine, and it kind of inspired this topic, where back in the 90s, you know, we didn't have flash drives or anything like that, really. You know, I guess the closest thing we had were CD-ROMs or zip disks. But back then, if you were savvy enough to order some stuff from Hong Kong or Taiwan, there were some Mega Drive, SNES, and N64 add-ons, like things you could put on your like Mega Drive or Genesis that would let you play from a floppy disk. And these things, I had one of these back in the day, and very fond memories, but I'm going to kind of go in order that they were released. So the first one that was ever released is called the Super Mega Drive. And it's this kind of 80s looking black device that kind of looks like Atari technology that just sits on top of your Mega Drive or Genesis. It was built for the Gen 1. And you could use it to play and copy Genesis games from a floppy disk. And you would usually get these from a BBS. That's how old this is. Mm-hmm. A bulletin board system before the internet. It also had a parallel port, and that you could plug into your PC and use a little application and load up games right from your PC. One interesting tidbit about this is that you used 1.44 megabyte high density floppies, but it actually formatted them to 1.6 meg. So if you had a 24 megabit game, it would fit on two floppy disks.
Okay. Right, because Genesis games can go up to basically 4 meg, till 7 FFF, whatever maximum addressable page value is. Mm-hmm. It's like the same page size as the PDP-11. I don't ask me why I know this stuff.
Nice. Well, so it seems like with this, you know, hooking it up to your computer is the way to go, you know, because loading up floppies each time would probably not be too fun. But that was the first device, and really the only one for non-Nintendo that I know about. And let's just say that, you know, we're not going to go over every single device. This is not a definitive cartridge copier topic, just kind of the bigger ones. So hopping over to SNES and Super Famicom, there was the Superdisc Interceptor and the Professor SF2, and also the Super Wildcard DX. So those were the three that were the big ones at the SNES. They all used floppy disk. I think most of them could have cheat codes. at least one of them, the professor had save states. And even if the game doesn't, you know, have, you know, saving or anything like that, it could still do a real save state. And the professor also could slow down your games. So if there was a really fast game that you wanted to get better at and you, you know, just needed to slow it down to kind of see what was going on, that was kind of a neat feature. These, again, like, I don't even know. A buddy of mine had one of these. I don't even know, like, where you would get this stuff from. I think most of these games were probably on BBS as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have to watch out for, though, is, you know, these are three different, you know, devices made by three different companies, and I think each of them had their own file format. So yeah. when you backed up your cartridge, so you'd have to make sure if you weren't backing up your own cartridges, you had to make sure to download the right the right file format.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, what incentive would they have to collaborate on a common format?
Yeah, exactly. jumping over to Nintendo 64, probably the coolest device is the Dr. V64. So Bung Enterprises made one of those SNES products, and also, yeah, they made the Professor SF, and they also made the Dr. V64. And what's cool about that device is that it plugged into the bottom of your Nintendo 64, and it was actually a dev kit. Acclaim used it for Turok 3 while Nintendo was suing Bung Enterprises. So there's some cool articles and YouTube videos about all that stuff. Really interesting history there. I did not have one of those, but it had a CD-ROM. So pretty much what you would do by this time, more people were on the internet. IRC and Usenet were bigger. And so you would just download a bunch of games, burn them to CD, and it would play them. I had the Mr. Backup Z64. I have no idea how I got this thing. I must have just gone to some you know, Taiwanese website or something. But it plugged into the, it was not a... dev kit. It was just a zip disk based game copier. So you put it on top of your Nintendo 64, you put a zip drive in, and then you also put a game at the top. So you could back up your game to zip disk, or, you know, you could download from IRC or something like that. Yeah, really cool. You know, I had a really good collection of games that I did back up, but I would also get on IRC and download games that were never released here. You know what I mean? And that's really what I used it for. And I had so many zip disks. A lot of the games for Nintendo 64 weren't that big. So you could, man, on some of those, I would fit 8 to 10 games on a zip disk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the later games, you could barely fit one. But,
you mean like iOmega zip drive?
Yeah. So 100 megabytes.
You could fit awful lot of games in there, I imagine.
The later games got pretty big, but yeah, it was more than serviceable. But those are all the devices I had, you know, noted down to talk about. You know, some features I wanted, well, some notes I had in here about all of them is, you know, now you can remove the floppy or the zip disk part of it and put a USB adapter or a CD-ROM adapter. If you're using the Nintendo 64 ones, the .Z64 or the .V64 file formats will, I think, work on both devices. They were universal. And in fact, when I accidentally downloaded that demo from earlier, it was a .Z64 file. So I knew exactly what I was downloading. But yeah, I remember walking over to my buddy's house, and he didn't even tell me he had, I think he had the Super Wild Card for SNES. And I just remember seeing that and walking in and being like, what the heck is that? And my mind was just blown that it actually worked. You know, we just, you know, loaded up some Final Fantasy game, mm-hmm. you know, right from floppy.
So were there like load, like, I guess my question is, what was the load time like?
Not great, but, okay. At least one, I think the Super Wildcard Plus had a battery in it. So for a long time, it would keep the game memory resonant. So the next time you turned on your Nintendo, I'm pretty sure it would just load up that game. So after you booted it once, you were good to go. That could be wrong, but I'm almost positive one of them did those. Now for the Z64 Mr. Backup, the load times weren't that bad. 10 to 25 seconds, depending on the size of the game. And, with those games, you probably weren't jumpy between games that much, you know. But yeah, mine was solid. It worked great. So, if any of our listeners have any experience with these devices or any other devices like these that you would like to bring up, whether you had one or you wanted one, you have any memories about them, please let us know. Email at retrogameclub.net. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes, you know, versus just getting a CDR drive a few years later. That's not quite the same thing, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Since many early CD-ROM games just didn't have any copy protection.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember chip modding a few PlayStations back in the day, and that was, and they did have copy protection, but yeah, pretty easily defeated. But yeah, but Dreamcast, yeah,
I
was gonna say,
I thought
Sega
PlayStation
CD,
you could just do like a, I thought the disc swap worked.
I forget if a disc swap did work on PlayStation, but maybe you just needed a chip to not have to do that. I can't remember. It's been so long.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the only systems I was interested in really were Sega CD, TurboGrafx CD, and those. There's no protection of any kind.
Yeah, and I think the funniest story from all those is Dreamcast, because, you know, the Windows CE portion of Dreamcast kind of mm-hmm. opened it up to easily hackable, and I know I'm not getting the story 100% correct, but I know I'm pretty close, where either someone acquired or stole a Dreamcast development kit and just used it to copy from GD-ROM to CD-ROM, and it pretty much, this one person pretty much single-handedly ended Sega's console career. Just nuts.
Yeah, one of my weirder yard sale pickups over the years is someone had like a Case Logic CD wallet. You're familiar with the concept of a CD wallet, I hope. You know, you had a card in the 90s. You probably had a CD wallet, right?
Yes.
And it was just filled with bootleg Dreamcast games.
That's a strange pickup.
40 or so bootleg Dreamcast games. And I think they wanted like $5 for the wallet.
At that point, it's like, why not?
Exactly. I'm like, why not? Why not get a bunch of bootleg Dreamcast games?
Yeah, most of them didn't take up the whole GD-ROM, so it didn't even matter that they didn't even have to cut out any audio or compress it or anything. But yeah, it was back in the day much harder to copy cartridges. Should we jump into some game club?
Yeah.
Mine, I didn't get into that much.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I didn't put any effort into it, though. So I did Dynamite Heady on the Genesis. It's a 1994 treasure game. Pretty critically acclaimed. There was I think, Game Gear and Master System port, at least in Brazil. And yeah, you play Dynamite Hetty, who is a puppet with a detachable head, and you're trying to make it so this evil king puppet doesn't take over your puppet kingdom. And you run around hitting things with your head and jumping around. It's definitely a platformer. Really bright and colorful. And this was a follow-up to, Gunstar Runners? Is that the name?
Gunstar Heroes? It's mechanically similar to Gunstar Heroes.
Yeah, yeah. They just didn't want to do a direct sequel to that, and the creator also had done sequels before this and just kind of wanted his own IP and came up with this concept. And my experience with this isn't great, but I don't blame the game. It just didn't click with me, the mechanics of it. When I was hitting stuff, I really, even though it would make kind of the little star shape hitbox thing when you hit something, I couldn't tell if I was causing damage on stuff, and I don't know, I didn't get very far in this game. I should mention that you could get like 15 to 17 different power-ups, so that means just like different heads and stuff, restoring your health, increasing your speed, making your head stronger, that kind of thing. I should definitely try to give this another chance. This is on the Sega Genesis Classics Collection. It's on Steam. It was on like PS3, Xbox 360. There was supposed to be a 32X port, but it got canceled. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on this one?
So, visually, I like the game a lot. That's about kind of where it ends for me. I think it's a really good idea for a game. Mm-hmm. I just did not particularly care for the way it plays. Gunstar Heroes is another one that's like, I like the visuals and kind of the play style of Gunstar Heroes, but I never can get further than one or two levels in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to explain why, other than it's like, okay, that was kind of cool. And then I'm ready to move on to something else. And this has the same thing. Like, visually, it's one of the most visually impressive Genesis games.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt. I just didn't particularly feel like playing it for very long.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of the visuals, yeah, I should mention it was inspired by the film director, Terry Gilliam, from like Monty Python and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, it's almost like a precursor to Cuphead in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah, so sorry, everyone. I don't have too much to say about this one. And I don't want to put any fault on the game. I think it's all me. You know what I mean? Like you said, it's like, didn't grab me.
Yeah, it's just not. It's not a type of game I normally pick up and play. It's kind of what it is. But I think it's, like I said, it's technically a pretty outstanding game. Just not my thing.
Yeah, yeah. Want to hop onto your game?
Yeah, I went with Q-Bert. And I actually played, I have like one of these little miniature Q-Bert arcade cabinets is what I played it on. You know, the thing you get at like Target for like $20. But it's not the arcade version of Q-Bert. It's some home version of it, right? It feels very close to the NES version.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Q-Bert's, hopefully people, it's a kind of a difficult game to explain, but you're Q-Bert and you have this pyramid board and you have to hop on the different squares of the board and then the squares change color. And there's various enemies that come after you. And you always move diagonally, which is like really sort of mentally challenging to do. If you've been playing a lot of 2D games, you have to actually like consciously think of like I'm moving in, you know, four different directions than what I normally use. So that's cool. Some of the enemies just kind of go around the board randomly. Others actually chase you. You know, the main enemy, which I believe is called Coily, I think is his name. He comes directly after you. He's the bouncing snake. And you can only get rid of him by tricking him into jumping off the side of the pyramid. And then later stages, it just gets more difficult. Like you sometimes have to jump on every square twice, things like that. More enemies. What I think is funny about Q-Bert is like the people who have like world records at Q-Bert, I guess there's some ways to like get huge numbers of lives in Q-Bert, right? So you can get a lot of bonus lives. And then it actually takes you a long time to die. Like if you're playing Pac-Man and you just like let go of the controller and like go to the bathroom or take a nap, you're probably going to like it'll be game over by the time you come back, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Q-Bert, if you can bank like 20 or 30 lives, because it takes so long for... Because on the initial starting square for Q-Bert, no objects ever land on there. So you actually have to wait for like Coily to spawn and then for him to work his way up to the top of the pyramid. So if you have a big bank of extra lives in Q-Bert, you can actually take like an hour nap while you're playing.
That's great.
Yeah, and that's how people set like the crazy world records on Q-Bert.
Nice.
So that's pretty cool. I thought that was fun.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I originally played this on Intellivision. And the Intellivision port is actually, it's a pretty good port.
Okay. Yeah, I did the NES port.
And, okay, so what did you think of Q-Bert?
Yeah, it's a good game for what it is. Like you said, getting used to the controls is a bit difficult because in the cabinet, the four-way stick is at a 45-degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a lot more sense. And also, when you on the arcade cab, if you fall off the side... There's a little mechanical device that you could hear the thud if you would actually hit the ground. It's like mm-hmm. a little hammer that hits the side of the inside of the arcade cabinet. That's really cool. Yeah, it's a fun little game for what it is. It's on every system ever, I think. Mm-hmm. So anyone could play it wherever they are.
Yeah, it was ported to everything in the 80s.
Yeah.
The NES version lets you customize the controls, if I remember right.
You could do some 45-degree angle control or 90-degree angle. I'm not sure which is easier. Like, I think one of them, you're meant to hold your controller at kind of a 45-degree angle. You know what yeah. I mean?
This was a case where the Intellivision controller was actually the better controller. Because you can do diagonals on it more easily than like a NES pad.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, not a bad game. Obviously, the sound is iconic.
Mm-hmm.
The little speech synthesis chip in there. But yeah, Gottlieb was kind of known for being cutting edge on their sound. But yeah, any closing thoughts on Q-Bert?
No, I mean, sort of like Dynamite Head, like I can play it for a stage or two and then... Like, that's all the Q-Bert I can take for one day.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you want to play for next episode?
I am going to do 1080 snowboarding.
That's Nintendo 64.
Nintendo 64. Yeah, I think it's only Nintendo 64. I don't think it got ported to anything else. Wait, was it made by Nintendo? Is that why?
I don't think it was.
Developer Nintendo.
There you go.
Producer Shigeru Miyamoto.
Really?
It says producer wow. Shigeru Miyamoto right here. Wow. On Wikipedia. Would Wikipedia lie to you?
No. Wow, that just surprised me.
Looks like it might have been developed by a European company. So this could be a similar situation to Pilot Wings 64,
mm-hmm.
where it says Nintendo all over it, but it was really people that weren't Nintendo that built it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, cool. Yeah, I almost picked that one this week. I think we're both feeling that it's the middle of winter. Might as mm-hmm. well play a wintry game.
Oh, yeah. And what did you pick?
I pick Slalom on NES, but since it's not a very deep game, I have another... let's call it a hard mode game where it won't be easy for any of our listeners to get or play. So if you don't want to play Slalom, our bonus game is Waku Waku Ski Wonder Spur. It's on SNES. Again, it is Waku Waku Ski Wonder Spur. And it's F-Zero on skis. It's a real game on the Super Famicom. So
mm-hmm.
It's a 1080 snowboarding, Slalom, or Waku Waku Ski Wonder Spur.
Yes, I think I have a physical copy of Slalom also.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Waku Waku.
No, I don't have that. I think I have a physical copy of Solemn, and I have never played it.
Oh, yeah, it's not a bad game, but yeah, we'll get into that next episode. And if any of our listeners, you know, have any comments about any of the games we play, if you've played them, if you have news suggestions, item suggestions, if you've ever had a console cartridge copier, we'd love to hear from you. Email at retrogameclub.net. That is email at retrogameclub.net. Or on Facebook, facebook.retrogameclub.net. You get past all the craziness on Facebook. Or Twitter at RGC Podcast. Joe writes in, talking about Tech Mobile, which I think was last episode. One of his, probably his favorite American football game. He loves it and the sequel, just absolute classics. He had a copy of it with his first NES in 2016, which he got with RC Pro-Am and Ninja Turtles, which those are three great games to get with your NES. The other football game he loves is NFL Blitz, which is a great pick-up and play style game. Bubble Bobble, another Game Club game. He was really interested in playing back in the day. It has some cool cartoony characters and original mechanics. Nice little puzzle aspect of it. And the levels are surprisingly challenging. And he loves that you know, you're pretty much forced to play two-player if you want the real ending. So, yeah, thanks, Joe, for that email. And I pretty much agree with all that.
let's see. Rob writes in to talk about King's Quest. So King's Quest is a series he first played at a friend's house. His friend had King's Quest on the Apple II, and he's just definitely something he wanted to get for himself. Later on, he got Apple II GS with King's Quest II. Nice. Really liked it, but couldn't solve all the puzzles, so he had to get the hint book that was written in invisible ink. Interesting. Wow. I'm familiar with the later ones that use the red plastic. Have you seen those?
Yeah, yeah.
The red plastic ones were pretty great, I thought. And he said the same problem with King's Quest 3. And from that point on, he got hooked on Sierra games.
Nice.
He said later on bought the King's Quest Companion, which I guess had walkthroughs for all the then current games. And he didn't own a hard drive yet, so it was 10 seconds for each screen to load from disk. Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah, and then he was very jealous when he saw King's Quest 4 on PC because, you know, it looked a lot better and had a newer, better game engine. So we had no choice but to get an Amiga and then later a PC just to keep playing King's Quest games. And how amazing they were in 256 color. Ah, yes. And he says... he thinks the best in the series was King's Quest VI, with better voice acting and a better story overall, and that there were two ways to reach the end of the game, a short path and a long path. I think we missed that when we talked about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And also being more patient back in the day, he had a single speed CD drive for this game, so it took about a day to load everything. he said 7 was unique, which I think is a polite way of saying it was bad. I don't know. He said, anyways, he's bought all these games through collections over the years and got really frustrated with Mask of Eternity and gave up on it right away. I think due to the controls, it sounds like. And from what he's watched, their independent remakes of the early games are free and worth playing with, you know, full voice acting and updated graphics. And, yeah. Says thanks for covering King's Quest.
It was absolutely our pleasure. I had fun recording and researching that one. And yeah, thanks Rob for that one. Adam writes in. He's a big fan of DuckTales and Bubble Bobble on the NES. And he played both of them a lot as a kid. And it was great to hear about the two games. He picked up Bubble Bobble for the DS and enjoyed playing it. He recently picked up Chrono Trigger for the DS. Wants to know our thoughts on that game, if we have any. I haven't really played that one. You a Chrono Trigger fan?
Yeah, yeah. I've played through Chrono Trigger. I believe I have done all, like, 13 endings in Chrono Trigger.
Oh, wow.
The, The DS version has like a tracker for how many endings. First of all, you can get all it's two playthroughs to get through all 13 endings. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but so once you finish Chrono Trigger, you can do a new game plus on Chrono Trigger. Mm-hmm. And when you're in new game plus mode, you can go fight the last boss at any time. So you can go directly to the ending. So you can go fight the last boss and then come back and, you know, resume the story again and then fight them again, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And depending what things you've completed in the game, you get a different ending. That's how you get the 12 other endings.
Okay.
And then I think the DS might have a bonus ending that's not in the original Super Nintendo version. Chrono Trigger, you know, it was a game for a really long time I didn't really play. I didn't have a Super Nintendo when it was first new, or maybe I did. I probably did, but I was working at the game store, so I didn't have any money. And Chrono Trigger was one of those games that, like, it was always $70 and it always sold out whenever we got it. We would get, yes. We'd only get one or two copies a week. It wasn't like, you know, a huge game, but people always bought it right away and said it was awesome. I first played it on the DS many, many years later. And I think story-wise, it's still my favorite story in a video game.
Huh, cool.
It's really, really good writing. It has a team of writers. Some of them, you know, like the guy that wrote Final Fantasy VII worked on it. You know, like it was the guy who came with Dragon Warrior worked on it. Like it was a lot of like big name writers. So it's a really, really good story. And you know, if you don't like turn-based RPGs, maybe you won't like it. The battles are really easy. It's a pretty simple battle system, and you don't really have to do any grinding. You know, it's not like other 16-bit RPGs at the time where you have to, you know, fight hundreds and hundreds of battles just to survive.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. Well, going back to his other DS game that he picked up, Bubble Bobble, I wonder if he got the one that wasn't fixed. So, Adam, can you get through level 30 on Bubble Bobble for DS? Because, yeah, you may have a pretty expensive game there. He also picked up Radiant Historia, which I've never played, also on DS. So he's been on an RPG bender, and he noticed Hugh has been as well. But yeah. I think you always are. You know, are you ever not in an RPG bender?
it's been more. I would say in past few years, it's certainly been more. I mean, I've been playing more RPGs and fewer games that require like lots of reflexes.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, part of it's like I don't know. I don't know. It's an old age thing or something here, but I just sort of find RPGs to be more more relaxing than playing like a Grand Theft Auto game. And the other things I've never been huge on shooters. I mean, I liked Doom a lot back in the day, but I'm not into like super like Doom. All things considered, Doom is not really a very gory game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of the graphics. Like,
yeah,
it can only be so realistic. And I don't particularly like, you know, the shooters where you're that are really like over the top gory. You know, so there's that. And I don't know. But yeah, mostly play RPGs now. I mean, when Breath of the Wild 2 comes out, whatever you want to categorize that as, I will play that probably exclusively for a few months.
Yes, agreed.
But yeah, mostly I play like RPGs and Bust a Move. That's about all I play now.
That's funny. He recently picked up a new 3DS XL, which he has been spoiled by its immense RPG backlog, and he's really impressed with the system, and you know, and he loves that, you know, it's backwards compatible with DS, and you know, like I really think that the new 3DS might be my favorite game console. It just, with the backlog of DS on it, the 3D on it, you know, you could disable if you don't like it, but it is really impressive compared to the original 3DS's 3D system. And just so many fantastic games and collections on it that, and the battery lasts a long time too. I do think it might be my all-time favorite console. That's saying a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So Adam, yeah, the new 3DS XL, right? that only has like a couple of games that are like that take advantage of the new hardware.
Yeah, I forget which games. There were a few that chugged on the original 3DS, like what was Samus Returns, I think, was a bit chunky on the mm-hmm. original 3DS. I forget the other ones, but and also the analog stick on it is just, it's just not great, but I rarely use it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I'm just saying the number of games that like our new 3DS exclusive is pretty short.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's pretty much the analog of Super Graphics. You know, there's like yeah. five games.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good, that is a good one. Yeah. Yeah. It is a Super Graphics, essentially. Now, I picked up, it's not an exclusive game, but if you're into like weird Falcom games, there's exactly one on the 3DS. It's called Gurumin. And it's a download-only game. But sometimes it just goes on sale for like $3. I don't know what the usual price is.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but I bought it for like $3. I already had it. It was a PSP game originally. And then the thing about it is the like on the PSP, the camera is just horrible and broken. I mean, it's a PSP game. Like, I don't know of a PSP game that has a good camera.
Yeah,
that's sort of a trade. Like, I like the PSP is one of my favorite systems of all time. It really is, but there's no system with a worse camera. Like, it's almost better off this being a 2D system. You know, I played through like the Final Fantasy VII prequel on PSP recently, and like this game would be incredible if the camera just worked. Like, and this has the same problem too. It's sort of an action. It's not really, even though it's a Falcom game, it's really not an RPG. It's more of a kind of like action dungeon crawling game. And I think on the 3DS, they fixed up the camera a little bit. A different company did the port. So yeah, a company called Mastiff, yeah, who I think mostly just do game ports.
Yeah, just... what a catalog for that system. And if you go to a game store, you're going to find, you know, just hundreds or thousands of DS and 3DS cartridges. Doesn't it also play Game Boy Advanced, or am I wrong?
No, it doesn't have the slot anymore.
Oh, it doesn't have a slot. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's right. The original DS did, right?
Wait, hold on. Where is the very, very, very original? Yes, maybe.
I think.
Hold on. So I have here my new 3DS XL, which
nice.
Since we don't have a screen, I have to have it here. I have a charging table, and there is definitely not a Game Boy slot on this.
Okay, yeah, that must be some kind of Mandela effect in my brain. Okay, the Nintendo DS is backwards compatible with Game Boy Advance cartridges. The smaller Nintendo DS game carts fit into the slot on the top of the system, while the Game Boy Advance games fit into the slot at the bottom. So that must have been just the original. I don't know.
The original kind of clunky-looking DS. I've never owned an original DS.
It's been so long since I had. I think I gave it away to a friend or something. It's funny. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts lately while shoveling snow and stuff. And I've been really impressed with how podcasts like the Pie Factory and stuff like that do all this research on the games they cover. Like, we can't even remember if the DS plays a Game Boy Advance game.
Yeah, yeah. In my defense, the DS Lite was the first version I owned because I really thought that original DS was. I realized the first time I saw the DS, I'll be pretty blunt. I thought it was kind of gimmicky and probably wouldn't work.
Same. Oh yeah. Same.
I mean, I really obviously missed the mark on that one.
I got it for that Brain Age game, and that was about it.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, this, like, no one's gonna want this. Like, so yeah.
And it became one of the best-selling systems ever.
Yeah, I mean, collectively, all 3DS variants, I believe, are number one. Correct?
Even ahead of
the PS2.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Maybe the Wii was up there. I don't know. I did hear on, I don't know if it was a podcast or some other show that, like, last month in Japan, the 3DS outsold the latest Xbox.
That's amazing.
To tell you and how well surprising. The Xbox systems do in Japan.
Yeah. That is great.
It's basically just American dudes living in Japan that buy it is
probably
is what I understand.
Well, Adam, thank you for that email, even though we went off on a crazy tangent. That's what this podcast is for. And we got some social media here. We got, tell us what you think Hubert means by, and then he does the squiggly lines and stuff when he hits an enemy.
And then after we filtered out all the inappropriate ones, we're left with courage isn't having the strength to go on. It is going on when you don't have strength.
I like it. And then we have some of the MSDEXP questions we asked, which is that acronym, what I just said, is the adapter for the side of the Genesis thing that we talked about last episode. Just go back to last episode. I think I talked about it in the intro. Someone's saying that, you know, it's a cool item, but it won't support EverDrives. Crix, the creator of EverDrives, say that he's probably not going to upgrade the firmware to do it. But really, that's okay because it's built for the Mega SD. So there you go. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to buy both, but I have these people are saying that it's the Mega EverDrive Pro. I have the first version, which I think you could get for $17 now of the Mega EverDrive. I wonder if that will work. I doubt it, but I'll let you all know when I finally get that adapter in March.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, to wrap it up, we got Slalom, Waku Waku Ski Wonder Spur, and 1080 Snowboarding for Game Club games. And I think that's about it.
Yeah, I think so. So thanks for listening.